Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
The swashbuckling adventurer, the joys and sheer wonderment of actually engaging with excitement, dynamism, and just general all-round good cracking narrative storytelling. We can only be referring, of course, to the latest incarnation, the latest text from our author of the week today, Play of Shadows, in which Damalas Shardmantane, and I'm sure I pronounced that completely wrong. Could it be Shardmantane? Could it be Shardmantane? Let's ask the creator, Sebastian de Castell. How do we pronounce the lead character in Play of Shadows?
You had it right the first time. It's Damalas Shardmantane, which, interestingly enough, was the first character name I ever thought of, like many, many decades ago, before I ever even thought of writing a novel, and have held it in reserve until this book, Play of Shadows, where at last I get to use that name.
Which is excellent. And indeed, just to give you a little teaser to that, Damalas, I'll just refer to as Christian name, I think, although Shardmantane is something I could probably get my tongue around eventually, picked a poor knight to flee a judicial duel. He has precious little hope of escaping the wrath of Vixen, the most feared duelist in the entire city, until he stumbles through the stage doors of the magnificent Operato Bellezza and tricks his way into the company of actors. An archaic law provides temporary respite from his troubles until one night, a ghostly voice in his head causes Damalas to fumble his lines, inadvertently blurting out the dreadful truth. I mean, you've already got me hooked on that side of things, and I'm sure that, assuming microphone problems have been sorted through, Anna Coscarell will be even more delighted. How are you, Anna?
I am good, Alex. I am so happy and honored to have you, Sebastian, again with us. It was the last time we had you. It was amazing. This time is just unbelievable. It sounds, as Alex said, so interesting, the book, and I think everyone will love it.
Oh, thank you so much, Anna. And again, it's lovely to see both of you again.
Yes, it's the growing group of Romanian Sebastian de Castell fans that are actually, you know, Bucharest is waiting to welcome you with open arms, Sebastian.
I do, in fact, have books translated into Romanian, so it is.
Yes.
There's a couple of, I think, Spellslinger books in Romanian. Hopefully Play of Shadows will one day make its way into Romania as well.
I hope so as well. But when it comes to books, I always love to read them in the language of their writers, because I feel like when they get translated, they lose a bit of the message, at least. Just.
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating area, actually. So in some ways, I sometimes almost find the reverse. I mean, readers rarely, I think most of us rarely understand just how incredibly talented you have to be a fiction translator. Because, of course, it's not, as you say, simply a matter of translating the words. Yeah. There are all the idioms that don't transfer over. I have a wonderful habit of creating character names that are absolutely fine in English, but when translated into some other language, end up meaning a particular body part or bodily function that would rather confuse the narrative. But they have to have a sense of flow and style and cadence. And, you know, the translation of a fiction book is almost like the writing of an entirely new book. And I quite kind of love that idea. Interestingly enough, one of the challenges for writers in my sort of general category where you do get books translated, is that one of the biggest challenges, of course, is that people will read the first book in their native language. And then, as you say, go, oh, well, I want to read book two. It's not out in Romanian yet, but it's out in English. So I'll go and read that. And so the poor publishers then, you know, can't earn a living on translations very easily. So they start only translating one or two books at a time, which is totally fine as well. I'm happy for people to read my books in whatever language suits them.
That's true. Is there any language that you like so much that you consider of learning just to write one of your books in that language?
Yeah, I think Italian. I don't speak Italian at all, other than a few words. I speak French, but that would make it even more daunting, I think, to try to write fiction in French. Although I'm going to be spending 2 months in France this summer with my wife, because she wants us to improve our French. So I have conversational French, but not very good written French. So maybe that'll change my mind. But there's something about Italian that always fascinates me, and I think that might be why the Italian sort of syllables and cadences make their way into a lot of the names and settings of Play of Shadow. You know, the Operetta Bellezza, which is the place where the theater in which a lot of the action and the magic takes place. You know, even Tristia as a country is a fusion of sort of an old French word and an Italianate ending. So yeah, I think it might be Italian. Maybe I'll learn Italian and write a book in Italian.
It's a definite line forward. Now let's move on to obviously the Great Coats and Spellslinger series. You haven't turned your back, I presume, Sebastian, on those, because there is a Great Coats connection with, of course, Play of Shadows. And we haven't even started talking about the boisterous and lusty friend Bretto, a beautiful assassin whose target may well be Damalas himself, in terms of that. Are you beginning to actually take the first steps to having a Castel verse or de Castel verse out there in terms of coalescing your texts together?
Well, in fact, there is something of a DeCastell verse, for want of a better term, and I think we should all try to come up with a better term by the end of the interview. So first of all, the entire Court of Shadows series, of which Play of Shadows is the first book, Crucible of Chaos, which I think we talked about a little bit on my last visit, is the prelude to that series. That's all set in the world of the Great Coats. It's set about 6 months after the events that end Tyrant's Throne, which was the conclusion of the first Great Coats Quartet. And of course, there's lots to do with our swashbuckling traveling magistrates that form the heart of this series of the Great Coats, because Damalas's grandparents were both Great Coats. He is, in fact, named after one of the legendary first Great Coats, which is why it's somewhat ironic that his first act in the story is to run in the most cowardly fashion possible from a judicial duel, which he himself instigated. So it is all set in that world. And as readers of the series know, there are many different orders in Tristia, in this country. So the Great Coats, who are sometimes called the Tretarii, are just one of them. The Bardati, who are the kind of performers, the bards, if you will, they're another one of these sort of ancient orders, charged with protecting the country and the memory of the country and the history of the country. One branch of that are, in fact, what were once called sacred actors, the Varistors, who were rumored to have this ability that if they played a historical figure on stage, they would at moments channel the spirit of that actual historical figure. Imagine the prospect of going to see Richard III, you know, in a theater, for example, in our world. But thinking that, you know, Sir Richard Burton or whoever was playing the character might suddenly channel the actual spirit of Richard III and how enticing that would be. And so that's what sort of sets off the core setting of Play of Shadows. But of course, I should mention that for those who haven't read The Great Coats, these books are very, very specifically designed so that you can literally jump in. If you've never read any of my work, you could start with Play of Shadows. And you'll be well supported on your reading journey.
Anna, back to yourself.
Back to myself. I was thinking with what you said now, at the end, that the readers can jump to any of your books to start reading. When you started writing in this manner, was it with the idea to make it easier for new fans to start looking at your work and reading your work? Or was it just a thing of it just happened and we went along with it?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I have the true answer. The answer I've been telling myself all these years is that I fundamentally think that a book should be a complete story. You should be able to pick it up and read the story, and it's the author's job to bring you back into it. Because remember, sometimes books are set, you know, a year or 2 years apart before their release dates. And so to ask a reader every time, you know, well, before you read this book, you got to go back and read the whole book. To give an example from the cinema, Dune 2 is coming out, the second Dune film. The first Dune film was wonderful, but I think I saw it 3 or 4 years ago. I have, you know, and they're actually telling you now, well, you better go watch the first one again because, you know, we don't bother explaining what happened. Now imagine that with a book where suddenly you're saying to the reader, well, this book that you want to pick up, which is ultimately supposed to be for your enjoyment and edification, often as you're going to sleep at night. But first you have to do your homework and go read, everything that came before. And I sort of gave up on that with the Song of Ice and Fire, the legendary Game of Thrones series, where I just couldn't bring myself to go back and read, a million and a half words as homework before I was allowed to read the next one. So that's part of it. I actually now have a slightly different theory though, which I'll try to make quick, which is I discovered at the ripe young age of 53 that I had ADHD and I've had it my whole life. And one of the characteristics of having ADHD is it's fundamentally a problem of what things motivate you, of what draws your attention and doesn't draw your attention. And one of the things that actually tends to excite my ADHD brain is finishing something. So the middle part of anything is incredibly difficult for me generally, but finishing something is fantastic. And that's true as a writer, but it's also true as a reader. So when I pick up a book and I get through that whole book, those 400 odd pages of a book, and get to the end and realize, oh, I didn't actually finish anything. The story's, it's just, they just split up a bigger story into three or four or seven or eight parts. I find that personally feels kind of dissatisfying. And so I like series, but I like series where every book is telling its own complete story. And that's the art form that I've chosen to try as best I can to master as a novelist now. And there's literally only one book I've ever written that I think feels like it's part one of two. And it was literally because the publishers wanted to get it out at a certain time and they didn't want it to get over a certain length. And I'm still kind of regretting that to this day. So.
Do you feel like when you are pressed by time, are you writing better or worse? Or do you like to have your own time frame of doing things after you, especially after you discover that you do indeed have ADHD?
I think that it varies very much. And let me tell you I'll tell you the small part first and then the more important part, what I think is the more important part. So there's no predictability to how long it takes me to write a book or what's involved. I can write a novel in 1 month and sell that novel, typically. Now, I say that only because that's happened a number of times now, including Crucible of Chaos, which is a very well-reviewed book that came out earlier, that came out in December in the United Kingdom and elsewhere in February. That was originally a one-month book, and I love to write that way specifically because I tend to write in four acts. And if I work really, really hard, and that's the only thing I'm doing that month, then it means that I can, in effect, as the writer, live the story. Right. So each week, I know that Monday is the beginning of an act. I know that it's got to feel like something big is starting. And I know that by the time we're Wednesday, I better be in the middle of the conflict. And I know that as we're hitting Saturday, that conflict has to be coming to a peak because I'm going to need that Sunday for setting up the next big act of the book. And that so that every time I write a book that way, and I think you can apply that different ways. You could do that over 2 months or over 3 months. It means I have to basically make my whole life the writing of that book, which is something that not everyone's in a position where they can do. But it means that that narrative drive, that underlying push is always there. Malevolent Seven was written that way. Crucible of Chaos was written that way. Fate of the Argosy, which is one of my favorite books, was written that way. There are other books, though, like Play of Shadows, that took 10 drafts. And the thing about writing a book over a long period of time is that books are, to some degree, always a product of their time. The ending of Play of Shadows changed when I did one of the final redrafts because the political climate around the world was changing. And I suddenly felt that the ending that I'd had, rather than feeling prescient, was feeling almost tired. And so I had to, something that was originally going to be quite a more downbeat style of ending needed to show more of an optimistic idealism to it. So that's the thing about writing long books. I'm writing a book right now called Our Lady of Blades, which is the most complex book I've ever attempted, and it's taking me years. But here's the final point on that I would make is that, when we live in a world where we're starting to feel like everything is manufactured. Products are manufactured. AI is writing news stories constantly. Goodness knows, let's pray that AI never becomes their radio hosts.
Oh, I think there are people who are trying to plan to put that into action even as we speak, actually. But there we are. That's another line entirely.
I think you're absolutely right. But I think therefore it's incumbent on those of us who have a connection to media and the arts to be constantly in search of the magic, so to speak. What is it that we can reach for that is not predictable, not AI generatable? And the only way I know how to do that is to treat each book that I'm writing as if it's its own adventure that I'm going on, like the process of writing it. What am I going to have to do emotionally, mentally, even physically, to kind of to reach for something that will be unpredictable to me, regardless of whether the readers might say, "Oh, it's a fun, lighthearted book that doesn't take itself too seriously." But I need it to be a process of searching for something magical, something different. And that's what I recommend to all writers. You make the writing of your first book an adventure, and you're far more likely to succeed than if you try to outwit the market or do anything like that.
I'm going to actually turn back to a mutual connection we actually have. Richard Edwards, of course, who was editor in chief for many years of SFX magazine. He stood down, but I noticed, Sebastian, you were a key author in one of their articles. And again, this ties in with what you've just referred to, Our Lady of Blades, a response to which of your books has been the most difficult to write. You claim it's been steadily driving over a cliff for the past several years because the unusual structure turns every page of chapters into a kind of narrative stage magician's trick. Every time one of those twists and turns work, however, it really does feel like magic. That sounds like a very complex way to approach the book. Any other teasers we can have about Our Lady of Blades?
Yeah, Our Lady of Blades is the sequel or the book that follows Play of Shadows. Each book in the Court of Shadows series functions a little bit like, the Marvel Cinematic Universe back when it was good, in which, each one is telling you the origins of a different character, and it's its own complete story, and you don't have to necessarily even read them in a particular order, but they all come together at the end. So Our Lady of Blades is set in a different city from Play of Shadows. It's set in a city of Rijou, which is the notoriously corrupt and violent city in the country of Tristia, where even the greatcoats feared to tread. And it's about a young duelist who appears on the scene in their notorious Court of Blades, which is where judicial duels are handled. And no one knows who she is, but she is our principal narrator. And meanwhile, we're frequently intercutting with the past of a different young woman who may or may not be the same woman, learning about the art of dueling and surviving in this city of intrigues. And there are interstitials seen from a third point of view of various scenes that those characters aren't aware of. And so structurally, it has a little bit in common with, the film Memento, which is a very dangerous thing to try to do with a fantasy novel. So when I try to describe it, it sounds impossible. And when I'm writing it, it mostly feels impossible. And then when I manage to get one part of it right, it feels like magic.
Makes perfect sense. So, again, referring to the interview, any progress with reading Don Quixote, or are you waiting to go onto a desert island before you actually start taking up the full Don Quixote epic?
Oh, I am definitely waiting for being stuck on an island. I feel Don Quixote is one of those books that will help one understand their position on in such a setting, and the both the futility and necessity of optimism. Though it's a it is cons widely considered, one of the greatest books of Western literature, but dauntingly large, especially for those of us with sort of ADHD brains. So yes, I will need the desert island and the lack of literally anything else to do in order to, be able to enjoy and appreciate that book.
Well, it's nice to see that you've got one of your characters emerging on screen at present for the benefit of the radio listener. Is this the official De Castel cat slash inspiration for so many fun characters?
Yeah, Peluche, our one of our two feral cats. So we have these two two cats that I was away playing a music gig in Poland when my wife, who's allergic to cats, temporarily adopted four of them. And because she knows I love cats, which was a generous thing to do because it led to 5 years of allergy shots for her. Also, we could end up with we adopted two of the cats and someone else adopted two. These two cats who were feral for all of maybe 3 weeks of their lives, but maintain as if like they've been feral the next 14 years. They're domineering, they're perpetually shy of strangers and yet treat us like they're butlers, and determined to never go hungry again. And if they want something, they have to have it right away. Peluche is partly the inspiration for Rikus, the squirrel cat in the Spellslinger series, and some of the behaviors that Rikus exhibits, many to do with thieving, murder, and the way he readily abuses Kellen, are all derived from Peluche, who's now kicking the microphone with his foot.
It's clearly wishing to communicate across the Atlantic Ocean and connecting with Europe and so on. Absolutely. And again, just referring back to the right stuff, the SFX author questionnaire, is your mantra for dealing with writer's block still beat the writer's block, don't beat up on the writer?
Absolutely, absolutely. My biggest, if I have a fear about the state of the world of writing right now, it's that it because it's so full of discussion of what is the right kind of writing and what tropes are tired and who should and who shouldn't be writing, and how if you've got writer's block, you should just tough it out, otherwise you're not a real writer. My biggest fear is that people who might have incredibly wonderful and new stories to tell will feel shy of trying to do that because, there's a reason why I don't think about becoming an astronaut, right? I'm too old, too fat, and and lack the intellectual skills and training required. You don't get to become an astronaut unless you're ridiculously wealthy and
I don't
vain.
know. William Shatner managed to go up with Jeff Bezos, so there you go.
I know, and wasn't science advanced so much by that voyage? Wasn't that really the thing that helped us, solve some of these intractable problems of space travel? No, but the point being that there are valid reasons why I should not be an astronaut or a gymnast, or a Delta Force soldier or any number of things. There is no reason why anyone with a story to tell shouldn't be a writer. That it is distinct from many other art forms in that it is a universal human heritage. It is one of the gifts of literacy is that we can write, we can communicate our stories. And so when we have, these kind of tough guy rules about only this kind of person should write something, or you should, there's no such thing as writer's block because there's no such thing as plumber's block, because there is such a thing as plumber's block. It's called anxiety and depression. Plumbers suffer from it all the time because they're human beings like we are. They don't solve it by hitting themselves with a lead pipe, nor should writers do so by banging their heads and just making them feel so hateful towards their own art form that they just want to get away from it. And so that's something I had to teach myself because writer's block is pretty much my default position. I sit, I don't, I'm not one of those people who sits down in front of the screen and goes, God, I just can't wait to start typing sentences. I have to find my way there. And so the trick, part of the trick, and I say this to anyone listening who wants to write a novel, is this is what I mean when I say you're not just writing a novel, you're going on an adventure, and adventures have bumps along the road. And your job is to just try different things to get you over each of those bumps in the road to just keep going forwards. And the best way to do that is with a sense of curiosity, a sense of experimentalism, and above all else, the ability to say to yourself, you know what, this is okay. We're going to figure this out. And so it sounds a little bit, lightweight since since I'm someone who writes about sword fights and, conflicts and clashes. But I can only do that because I've learned to, accept myself as a writer, as an artist, as a person. So that's what I encourage everyone to do.
As we said, you are a genuine definition of a polymath, musician, ombudsman, interaction designer, fight choreographer, teacher, project manager. actor and product strategist, as well as obviously award-winning author. If somebody actually said, okay, you can only choose two of those to actually focus on for the remaining 30 or 40 years of your existence on the planet, which one would you go for?
Well, husband wasn't on that list because if, for some reason I don't understand, it's still not considered a job. But that would be top and writer second. But if it's only two on the list, it's writer and musician for sure. Those are the two things that that I just adore. You know, and they're very different. Because one is all about a moment in time. It's being when you're on stage and you're playing with a band and everyone is so in the pocket with the energy from the audience that you're hearing more instruments than there are musicians. Those moments are wonderful. But being a writer is, being a novelist, I really think is the greatest job you can hope to have, or certainly that I could hope to have. The work that you do is never ephemeral. You finish a book, the book gets printed, you put it on your shelf. And again, this might be an ADHD thing, but ever since I became a novelist, I find, you know, I can remember each year now because each year had a book or books attached to it. So it's an absolutely wonderful career. I recommend it to everyone.
Trinity College London recently pointed out that their research had said the most popular tune that people wished they could play on the piano was Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. We'll hear more about that after this particular interview with one of the great conductors at the time. From your own musical areas, which instruments do you particularly specialize in or wish you could specialize in?
Well, I mostly when I get hired to play, play guitar and keyboards and sing. Occasionally I play bass. At one point I was learning a little bit of Celtic fiddle and Celtic flute. But that was just to, you know, challenge myself to try something new at the time. But yeah, probably mostly guitar and singing is sort of my natural, you know, set of instruments.
A genuine balladeer. Okay, back to Bucharest.
I was thinking you're doing so many things and you are talking with such passion about everything. And I'm just wondering in a parallel universe, how do you think that Sebastian that is doing archaeology would be like?
Well, terrible, because I think archaeology is a very bad profession for people with ADHD. It requires meticulousness. It's a lot like camping. If you're on a dig, you're often outside, you're sleeping in tents a lot of the time, and you're sitting there with a brush all day long. I think archaeology is a good profession for people who like knitting, who like that freeing the hands from the mind to some extent, or at least the archaeology that I experienced on my first dig, which was the cause for my rapid departure from the field. When I realized that I just could not at all stand it. But I suppose what I like to think is that I would have found my way to something, you know, that I fit into in archaeology, because most fields have room for all of us, right? The world's a big, complicated place. Even something like the military has, you know, so many different kinds of positions in it. You can be someone who's terrified of guns and can't stand them, and there's probably a job in the military where you can be excellent and helpful to your fellow human beings, within the bounds of what that military is asked to do. So I like to think that I would have found my way to something, but it was a struggle. One of the interesting things is one of the ways that when I was diagnosed with the ADHD, and the diagnosis, by the way, was absolutely wonderful because you suddenly go, okay, I see what it is. Like I'm starting to see, I have an avenue to see how my brain works and what motivates me and what gets me excited. And one of the ways that they identify it in adults, because adults who have there's a lot of adults who have ADHD, they're not often diagnosed, and the ones who don't get diagnosed, often it's because they find strategies, right? And we all develop strategies. So when I describe to somebody how I handle my author finances, because it's a very variable business, you don't want to be spending this year's money this year, because you might not end up with enough next year. So I pay myself behind. I have a whole system for that. And they said, and because if I don't do that, I lose track of money instantly, for example, and you know, taxes get behind and things like that. And so I remember the doctor saying that is exactly what people with ADHD tend to do. They build these strategies. And so the ones that don't usually end up in all kinds of dire consequences as they get into adulthood. So yeah, hopefully if I was still in archaeology, I would have developed a strategy to make myself competent at it. But I'm much happier to be in this world being a novelist.
Were you disappointed at all that it wasn't like Indiana Jones suggested it might be when you went into archaeology?
It was absolutely a disappointment. In fact, I remember when I started taking archaeology at university, and they used to talk about how every time an Indiana Jones movie came out, enrollment spiked. And that was terrifying for the archaeology professors because, you know, how do you work with ex even explaining the fact that there aren't, you don't raid tombs? And if you walked into any of those tombs and saw, oh, look, it looks like there's a trap here, the last thing you would do is set it off to get to the treasure. The trap is the story, not the treasure. That's the thing people forget about archaeology, is it's trying to understand how human beings lived through the material culture they left behind. So in that sense, the golden monkey's head at, you know, at the end of the first sequence of Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's not the thing that the archaeologists are looking for. They're looking for the traps themselves, if such a thing existed, because that tells you about how what people valued and how they protected it.
Civilizations rise and civilizations fall, the kind of constant mantra across the universe and so on. Will you be looking forward to seeing Dune 2 then? I mean, there is a kind of short Denis Villeneuve precursor beforehand. I mean, is it something which is on your list of things to do in betwixt obviously dealing with magical writing?
In fact, my wife and I are going to go see it this weekend. It does look rather wonderful. It's interesting because we had to start rewatching the first one yesterday, and there's a certain style of visual storytelling in science fiction that I find quite interesting because you know, my wife will often find it kind of a little bit stale, and it's almost as if whereas I'll often find it magnificent. I'm like, no, all the emotion is beneath all the gray surfaces of everything you're seeing. And so I find that quite fascinating when you see something that's so archly different as a cinematic style from so many other movies. You know, a horror movie, you know, all we can think of, it's very dark and has jump scares, but it's largely shot this in a similar way to, you know, a romantic comedy or anything else, right? You know, you're positioning actors and you're setting up scenes, but science fiction movies are almost shot more like, and they feel more like old westerns, right? Those sort of epic westerns, because, you know, often the characters are small in those frames. And so for some, and I'm quite fascinated as a storyteller, you know, even though my medium is novels, I'm fascinated by the different ways that human beings respond to that. That for some people, they see the small person on the big backdrop, and they feel the sense of they feel all the emotion of that hugeness of the world. Whereas for other people, they don't feel a strong connection to that. They feel it when they're seeing the big face of the person close on the screen, or the, you know, as TikTok tends to do, where we're all becoming invested in each other's emotional responses to things. So I'm looking forward to it. I
Yes,
think
well,
it'll be
it's something
fun, and I
we
think
do
you'll
share
learn.
because just before going live with you today, I did actually purchase a cinema ticket for myself to head off and actually see Timothée Chalamet's second incarnation as Paul Atreides and Paul Muad'Dib, etc. Although I still have a liking for David Lynch's attempt back in 1984, as I've already gone on record as saying. I think that was, even by himself, he was harshly critical about that. And Anna, I think we'll probably agree with respect to that as well when we reviewed it on a show called Resonance Rewind. Anyway, Anna, any closing questions from yourself for the last few moments for Sebastian?
Yes. Did you have a reasonably enjoyable Zuma with us?
Yes, has it been a reasonably enjoyable Zoomer for your return to our Author of the Week feature, Sebastian?
It has. I will tell you, I've been interviewed on national and international radio shows and televisions and things like that, and Siren Radio is always my absolute favorite interview. It's the best prepared, it's the most thoughtful, it gives the most opportunity for interesting discussions. It's the one where I walk away from it with new ideas, so I'm always incredibly grateful to get to come on this show.
Well, then we take it we'll be able to feature you again in the not too distant future. And at least as long as Siren Radio keeps going, you'll be able to join us as well via Zoom and other such wonderful technological delights.
Well, and maybe one day we'll find a way to do it in person, and that'll be even more fun.
That would
I'll bring
indeed
you a
be
sword.
a Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we could do some sword fighting on air, which would be extraordinary. And indeed, could well be my final program, but still, never mind. Oliver Zeffman, conductor extraordinaire, is coming up next. And then we might even indeed feature Professor Sir Carrie Cooper. But for the moment, it's been a delight connecting with the good self, Sebastian. A reminder, of course, that in terms of accessing you via the social media, what's the best place to go to? Do you have a website, or would you say, no, stick to me on Instagram?
Oh no, goodness, not on Instagram. I'm terrible on Instagram. I do try to respond when people attach things with my name on Instagram because it's very kind of them, and they make these beautiful compositions with my books. And I'm looking forward to seeing beautiful Instagram compositions with Play of Shadows. The cover is designed to have lots of interesting things around it. So, but the best way to reach me is through my website at decastell.com. That's DECASTELLTELL.com. DECASTELL.com. Sorry. But I'm very easy to find on the internet. I'm also on Twitter as at decastell. But if you reach me through my website on my contact page, I reply to every single email I get. I get letters every day. And I always take the time to write back as soon as I can. So, and I look forward to hearing from anyone and everyone.
Fantastic. And as we said, Play of Shadows is out now, well worth accessing from that point of view. And we look forward to certainly Our Lady of Blades. I'm fascinated by that. I'm sure it'll be a whole new. I mean, I can almost see now Christopher Nolan listening to this and saying, that's my next movie. That's what I'm going to go for. You know, that's the kind of complexity I'm looking for from that point of view. So, you know, for Mr. Nolan, go for it. Get the rights snapped up.
From your lips to Christopher Nolan's ears.
Siren Radio.
What a scenario without Siren Radio. Stand up, everyone, save our siren sounds. From Lincoln to Miami, Paris to LA, our global community wants to hear it play.
Siren Radio.
Let them all create students, participate. Keep on keeping on. Save our Siren Radio.
Every good boy deserves football, FACE, the sheer terror of actually going into a Methodist hall with the piano at one end and the examiner at the other as one goes through grades 1 through 8 in the practical music. I remember it well. But what is it about playing the piano in particular that still appeals, especially when I seem to be one who actually really quite enjoyed the notion of Eric Satie and his Gymnopédies and probably even Scarlatti, which was very challenging. But enough of such stuff. Let's talk to a true expert when it comes to music and the piano in general, and specifically with reference to some interesting choices of pieces ahead of the Brit Awards that Trinity College London have identified we all would like to play. We say a hearty welcome to conductor extraordinaire Oliver Zeffman to the programme. How are you, Oliver?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm excellent. Now, I mean, just a bit of background. I mean, I've got to say, I'm impressed with the fact that you were responsible for the world's first opera recorded on an iPhone. But even that, I think, was put into the shade by having a full concert under the Cutty Sark. I mean, good grief. This is phenomenal.
Thank you. Yeah, it's conducting can be a lot of fun.
Yeah, but it obviously means that you're prepared to, you know, like all great artists, think outside the box, etc. And the first thing that struck me about this top 40 actually, range of tunes that we've actually got for favorite piano pieces that people would like to be able to play, is that actually there are very few classical pieces in there. You have to go down all the way to number 28 to find Debussy and Clair de Lune. And most of it is very poppy.
Well, look, I think what's so exciting about this and what's important about the research at Trinity College London have found is that you can play, you know, whatever you want to play. And I think if you want to play, I don't know, In This Moment, Cinnamon, or you want to play Elton John's Your Song, and that encourages you to play the piano and to learn music, that can only be a good thing. You know, when I was a kid, I did my piano grades, and of course I was playing, let's say, more traditional classical music, and that was fine. And, you know, I work in classical music nowadays, but that's not to say that that's what everyone wants to do when they learn music, what everybody wants to achieve. And if you can play something that really speaks to you as a student, whatever age that might be, and encourages you to learn music and go through the grader system and give you a sense of achievement, that's a great thing.
I mean, interesting enough that I once said I would never actually be one of those adults who said, oh, I wish I'd kept it going. Of course, I have become one of those adults who said, I kept it going. I think I kind of plowed through until grade 7, grade 8, and then basically decided to go down the line of chemistry and biology, and the music sort of went to one side on that side of things there. But what advice would you give to people, possibly like myself, who may not have even touched a keyboard for a good few years? Is it something that, on a bit like riding a bicycle, we can still go back to?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it will have to take a little bit of time to get back into it. I used to play the violin, for example. I don't really play it anymore. And then during the pandemic, when obviously all stuff stopped, I thought, okay, maybe I'll get my violin out and pick it up again. But I didn't have the patience, if I'm honest, and I couldn't quite do what I used to be able to do on it. But, you know, had I stuck with it, even, you know, after a few years and had that little bit of patience, I'd have been able to pick it back up again. And also, I guess because I do music in my job all the time, there's less, you know, time as well. But if it's something that you want to do, you know, particularly with the piano, it's very easy to sit down and play and pick it back up again and enjoy it. You know, people learn instruments for all different kinds of reasons, whether that's for like relaxation, whether that's to have some kind of mental exercise and sense of progress, or whether that's, you know, there's a social aspect, of course, from learning an instrument. If you want to play in a band or in an orchestra or in a group or whatever it might be, there's all reasons to, and all kinds of ways to learn an instrument.
I was interested to see that 60% of parents who responded said that the piano would be their preferred instrument for their child to actually learn. Because I mean, I seem to have gone through a phase where some people like, as you say, the violin, other people preferred to actually go for other forms of music. The harp, I think the harp needs to make a return personally. I mean, I think that would be a nice one from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I love the harp. There's a lot of carrying it around, particularly if you're a parent with a child. You know, you've got to have a car that can fit a harp in or prepare to do a lot of heavy lifting. But it's a great instrument. I mean, the piano is obviously wonderful because it's so versatile. You can play it by yourself, you can play it with other people, you can play it, you know, to accompany somebody, you can play it, you know, there's just so many different settings, and it really lends itself perhaps even more than, I know, the violin, let's say, to all kinds of genres.
I mean, those top five tunes in terms of favorite piano pieces that people would love to be able to play: Bohemian Rhapsody coming in at number one, Your Song with Elton John 2, John Lennon's Imagine, The Beatles also with Let It Be at number four, and Adele's Someone Like You. So an interesting mix there. Were you surprised with the Bohemian Rhapsody choice? I mean, it's quite an interesting, complex piece, really, in terms of Scaramouche, can you play?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, you know, it's great music. And I think the survey wasn't what's the piece that is easiest to play. It's what's the piece would you most like to be able to play? And so there's, you know, a huge range there. There's, I don't know, there's loads of really great music. And I think it's really encouraging that people want to learn the music that they want to be able to play on the piano. And actually, the research has shown that I think since the pandemic, Trinity has seen more than 60% rise in people taking their piano exams. I think partly because there's this flexibility to learn the music that you want to learn, and learn it in a way that obviously speaks to you, because different kinds of music might be learning require a different way of teaching it. You know, you wouldn't learn to be a concert pianist playing Mozart and Bach and Szymanowski in the same way you would learn to be a pianist that plays, you know, Queen and Elton John or whatever. So it's really encouraging, I think.
Yeah, I must admit, I was disappointed not to see any sign of Eric Sarti at all in the top 40. I mean, I know it's simplistic and form, but I think that, you know, Gymnopédies were really quite simple to do, but very poignant, I found.
Well, yeah, I guess then it's your job to get back learning the piano and proselytize for Sarti. Yeah.
Clearly, exactly. Okay, in terms of your own favourites, did you have any which struck you as being great? I mean, one of the things we haven't mentioned, of course, again, just tying this in with the Brits, is that there are an awful lot of British artists being featured here.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, of these kind of songs, I think my favourites were Cinnamon in My Soul, is obviously not British. I, you know, being a classic music, I have a soft spot for some of the classic music, like Debussy, Clair de Lune, the Mozart. When I was a kid, I was listening lots because my dad was really into the Beatles. He used to listen in the car. So Beatles Let It Be is a top choice for me as well. It's a great list of music, basically. And it's really exciting that you can play and learn what the music that works for you.
I might have possibly gone for Song for Guy for Elton as well, as opposed to your song, but that's another line. And Land of Hope and Glory, of course, coming in at number 40. Elgar very much to the fore there. I mean, I never actually even considered that as being a piece for piano, really. It's extraordinary.
Well, look, I think, lots of music doesn't necessarily have to have been originally written for piano. The Dr. Dre song isn't a piano piece originally, but there's music that works with the piano and can be played on the piano, and most of this music are in, the grade books and the course books that Trinity College London offers. And I think that's the whole point, really. The piano is a very versatile instrument that lets you play whatever you want across all genres and all types of music. And it's really exciting that you can do that, and that Trinity allows you the opportunity to learn and study and progress your music in a way that works for you.
And we talked about portability with respect to the harp. I mean, obviously, shipping a piano around can be a little bit
No,
challenging as
sure,
well
but
from that point of view. With technology being what it is there the flexibility with respect to using some of the many and varied computer ways of actually playing keyboard instruments these days? Or would you say, no, you need to have a proper Steinway, otherwise it's not going to work?
no, look, I think you can learn anything in the same way, depending on what you want to do and what you want to achieve. You can have different kinds of instruments, and not everybody needs or wants a Steinway if they're only playing a few hours a week or something, which is a very legitimate way of playing the piano. And lots of places lots have pianos in a way that harps don't too. And I think the other thing, talking about technology, is that now with Trinity College London, you can do some of the exams online, because not everybody has the circumstances and the ability to be able to go to the hall or go and rehearse, depending on where you live and how you do things. So you can actually record your exam and upload it in a certain way, and the examiners can look at it in that way.
Well, obviously, that would prevent the whole sheer terror that was faced when you had to go through that very
I
cold.
remember it well.
There were always cold rooms, I thought, as well. They seem to be sort of, -4 in various ways. Family used to be wrapped up. Anyway, that's by the by. Okay, Oliver, where can people actually go to find out more details about Trinity College London?
You can find it on Trinity's website, Trinity College London /music-research.
And people who wish to follow your good self, Oliver, are you on the various socials?
I am. You can follow me on all the different social medias. It's just my name,
Fantastic.
Oliver Zefman.
Brilliant. Well, Oliver, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with you yourself today. Any more plans to have any concerts under the Cutty Sark?
No more under Cutty Sark, but if you're interested enough, you can come see me make my London Symphony Orchestra debut this summer at the Barbican.
Fantastic. This is great stuff. Oliver Zaffman, conductor extraordinaire. Huge thanks, and keep on
Thank
keeping
you.
on.
Thanks very much.
mudslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy. I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go. Little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter.
Just gotta get out, just gotta get right out. on a scenario with our siren radio. Sound up everyone, save a siren sound. Come link into Miami, Paris to LA. Our global community wants to hear it play. Students participate, keep on keeping up, keep on keeping up.
Sorry,
keep on keeping up.
Sorry,
keep on keeping up.
Sorry,
keep on keeping up. Say, Siren Radio.